are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1935, 9-year-old George Weyerhaeuser, heir to one of the wealthiest families in America, is snatched off the streets 2 blocks from his home. The boy is kept manacled in a pit, chained to a tree, and locked in a closet. The perps, a career bank robber, a petty thief, and his 19-year-old, never-been-in-trouble Mormon wife, quickly become the targets of the biggest manhunt in Northwest history. The caper plays out like a Hollywood thriller with countless twists and improbable developments. Perhaps the most astonishing thing of all, though, is how it all ends. The book we're featuring this evening is Deep in the Woods, the 1935 kidnapping of 9-year-old George Weyerhaeuser, heir to America's mightiest timber dynasty, with my special guest, journalist and author, Brian Johnston. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Brian Johnston.
How do you do? Good to talk with you, Dan.
Thank you so much for joining me with this incredible story.
It is.
Just to start, before we have this May 24th, 1935, you talk about in the beginning of your book just a little bit about some of the stuff that you needed to be able to research, be able to do this story the way you did. And so you talk about 2,500 pages of FBI documents, 200-plus newspaper articles, court transcripts, and interviews with George Weyerhaeuser himself. So I'll
give
our audience a little bit of an introduction. Let's get to May 24th, 1935, and tell us what happens. So take us back to where this is, Tacoma, Washington. Take us back to that that day. And why George was walking home without, say, this chauffeur that might have been able to pick him up. Tell us a little bit about his background, his family's background, and what happened that day.
Sure. So the Weyerhaeuser family, people in the Northwest are very familiar with the Weyerhaeuser name. The rest of the country, I'm not sure. And that was pretty much fine with them. George's great-grandfather, Frederick Weyerhaeuser, to this day, is still considered about the 12th richest man in American history, okay? The 11th being Bill Gates, okay? Super wealthy family. They were in the timber industry. As a matter of fact, the Weyerhaeusers own about 4% of the entire state of Washington. Here's a really goofy statistic for you. They own about 1/640th% of all of America.
Wow. Yeah.
Yes, they own a lot. So, very wealthy family, but the Weyerhaeusers always wanted to be a very unassuming family. They didn't like being in the spotlight. You know, back when Frederick was, you know, super rich man, this was also the time of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Astors and Vanderbilts, and he just wanted everybody else to have the spotlight, and he just wanted to quietly go about his business here in the Pacific Northwest. And he did. And that's been kind of the hallmark of the Weyerhaeuser family. Quiet, unassuming, and they wanted to raise their kids the same way. So George, 9-year-old George, he and his brother would frequently walk to school and walk home. Sometimes they'd catch a ride with the quote-unquote chauffeur, who was nothing more than the house gardener who would give him a ride now and then. And on this occasion, May 24th, George was at school, which is about a half mile from home, and he walked down to another school where his sister was going to school, and he was supposed to meet her there, and then their chauffeur would give him a ride the rest of the way. Well, he got there about 15 minutes early, and after waiting around for a few minutes, went, well, this is dumb. Why do I want to wait here? I'll just walk home. It's, you know, it's like 6 blocks. So he starts walking, and he's about 3 blocks from home when a car just pulls up in this little parking lot that he happened to just be in at that moment, nobody else around. Guy jumps out of the car, asks him a question. Hey, kid, can you tell me where Stadium Way is? George doesn't give it a thought. He says, yeah, sure. And then the guy grabs him, throws him in the back seat of the car, says, keep your mouth shut, nothing's going to happen, and drives away. Kidnappers now have George Weyerhaeuser kidnapped.
Now, it takes a little bit of time before anyone notices her, you know, George's parents are out of town. And so...
Well, they just... Yeah, exactly.
So tell
George's
us, tell
dad
us
got
when
home
they
that
exactly
day.
Notice... When do they notice this missing?
Well, the chauffeur, after he couldn't find George, he gets back home after dropping off his sister and thinks, well, that's kind of peculiar because George isn't here either. So he goes back out driving around for a little while and he can't find George either. So it wasn't until, you know, about, I would say, an hour or two later where they started getting seriously concerned. Then that evening, the ransom note shows up. And that's when they knew everything had gone sideways. By that time, George's dad was back in town, and George's mom was getting home that evening. It was, like I said, about 5 o'clock at night when they got the ransom note in the mail. It actually got delivered, hand-delivered to their house.
What did that ransom note contain? It had the conditions for this ransom, but also a fair amount of information for the family to follow.
Exactly. They had 21 demands. The first demand being that the kidnappers wanted $200,000 in small unmarked bills. Now, just to give you a sense of how much money that is,
yeah.
1935, during the Depression, the average income for people was $1,500 a year. So that ransom was the equivalent of 133 years worth of the average person's salary, all right? The Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which happened only 2 years earlier, those kidnappers originally only asked for $50,000. This was four times that amount of money.
Right.
Well, the Weyerhaeusers were wealthy, but they didn't have 200 grand in small unmarked bills laying around, and that was the number one demand. We want that money in 5 days or else. Some of the other demands were that you will communicate with us using personal ads in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer or newspaper, using a code name, the code name Percy Minnie. So this way, when the Weyerhaeuser family was ready to pay the ransom, they would place a personal ad in the paper saying, we're ready, or something to that effect, and sign it, Percy Minnie. The kidnappers every day would flip through the newspaper and the personal ads looking for that code word, and then they would know, you know, the Weyerhaeusers are ready to pay up. Some of the other demands, which were ridiculous, were don't tell the police. Ha ha, good luck with that. And also, do not tell the media, which also ridiculous. In fact, the ransom note said, do not alert the newspapers. So what did the newspaper do? They posted the ransom note on the front page of the newspaper.
Yeah. Incredible.
So, yeah, and the ransom note was signed, you know, basically said, you know, we consider ourselves very smart. We've been planning this for years. Don't get cute. Treat this as a business transaction. And signed it, egoist, egoist.
So a lot for the police to contemplate and try to derive some clues from this, especially with this Percy Minnie and with this egoist.
Right.
So
right.
Exactly. At that time when they're still at the beginning of their investigation, you also talk about J. Edgar Hoover and the beginning of the rebranding, so they become the FBI in 1935. But you also take us, meanwhile, you take us to 6 weeks earlier to a person named Margaret Whaley and her husband Harmon.
Yeah, and Bill Mahan. So those were the kidnappers. I guess we should probably qualify them as two and a half kidnappers. William Mahan, alias William Daynard, was the mastermind of this. Now, he was kind of a career bank robber. He'd spent a fair amount of time in prison, and he also had a way of sweet-talking his way out of prison, too, frequently. Harmon Whaley, who he met in prison, he was kind of a small-time criminal, and he and William Mahan had served some time together. and then Margaret was Harmon's wife. So Bill Mahan and Harmon just randomly ran across each other out on the streets in Salt Lake City about 6 weeks earlier. So Harmon says, "Hey, Bill, you got to come back to my house and have dinner with me and my wife." Harmon had met Margaret only 6 months earlier, dated for a week, and then got married. Margaret was 19 years old, never been in trouble in her life, but she was raised in the Mormon faith, and she was taught to always do exactly as your husband tells you to. And that was her undoing through this whole thing. Poor Margaret. She was a pawn in this whole thing, but she got caught up in it, unbeknownst to her. So Margaret and Harmon, they're totally captivated by Bill Mahan. He's a sweet talker, good salesperson. And he says, "Hey, I'm heading up to Spokane, Washington. I've got a job up there." He didn't. "Why don't you guys come with me? Maybe I can get Harmon a job too." A lie, because at the time, Harmon and Margaret had $6 to their name. And they're like, "Sure, let's do that." So they jump in Bill Mahan's car, and they drive up north. He stops along the way at this garage and says, "Hold on for a second." Opens a garage. There's a second car. "Yeah, this is my other car. Why don't you guys drive it?" And they're like, "Holy crap, this guy's got two cars during the Depression." They think their ships come in. Yeah. So they drive up to Spokane. They rent a house together. And, you know, they just go about their business. So they drive back. They drive across the state over to Western Washington, Seattle, Tacoma, and a little town called Hoquiam, where Harmon grew up. And Margaret's under the impression that they're, you know, that William's trying to help Harmon get a job and help him with his sales, as it were. Mm-hmm. Little does she know that they're actually casing banks, looking to, you know, to rob banks. They drive back across the state. And then Margaret totally changes the calculus of everything, completely unwittingly. She reads an article in the newspaper. It says, local millionaire warehouser dies. Well, this was George's grandfather, okay? And she just went, "Huh, that's really interesting." That's all she really said. Bill Mahan hears that, and he sees the angle. He's like, "Huh, local millionaire dies. So maybe he leaves a lot of money to his son. Maybe his son has kids. I see leverage opportunity." So Bill Mahan and Harmon head back west again. They tell Margaret again, "We're going to head back west. We got opportunities for sales." Again, a lie. They go back and they start looking for, they look through the newspaper, they look through the phone book, and they find the warehouser's phone number and address. They drive down. And they start casing the joint. And they see little George and his brother walk into school. And the light goes on for Bill Mahan. He's like, here we go. Here's my opportunity. So for about 2 days, they're casing this. They're tracking the kid. And so that's how the whole kidnapping came about. It really was just a crime of opportunity. She reads an article in the paper. She makes a comment. Bill Mahan, the light goes on. And they follow the kid, and they snatch the kid. It all came together in like 2 days.
You talk about just before this, about the state of kidnapping at that time, 1930 to 1932, how prevalent it was. And you also, of course, mentioned the Lindbergh case. So there's a new law as a result of that kidnapping. Tell us about that law and also just how kidnappings were in those 2 years, especially.
So the Lindbergh kidnapping pretty much changed everything. Because up to that point, criminals, back in the 20s when criminals were really popular, for lack of a better term, you know, Al Capone and guys like that, they would escape prosecution for all intents and purposes by simply going across state lines, okay? They would go from one state to the next, and then all of a sudden the cops in that state couldn't chase after them. So after the Lindbergh kidnapping, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, said, "This is ridiculous. We need this to stop." And so he enacts what everybody else called the Lindbergh Law, so that if you took somebody across state lines, it becomes a federal offense and that the FBI can get involved. Okay, And so that's how things changed. Kidnapping at that time was really, really popular. It kind of, you know, jumped in with bootlegging and, you know, all these other big crimes at the time. And criminals started to come to the realization this is a much safer way of making a buck. Grab somebody, hold on to them, offer ransom demands, and just wait for the money to show up. And it usually worked. But after the Lindbergh law came into effect, it didn't work so much anymore. In fact, the FBI, once the Lindbergh law kicked in and the FBI really got involved in capturing kidnappers, kidnappers failed almost every single time. But evidently, Bill Mahan and Harmon Whaley didn't know the statistics.
Let's get back to George being grabbed by this man and thrown in a car. What happens next to him, and what does George have the wherewithal to do as soon as he is grabbed?
Yeah. Right. So they throw him in the back seat, throw a blanket over him, and mention, you know, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, you'll be okay. And they drove about an hour north to an area outside of the Seattle area called Issaquah, out to a forest. Ironically, I don't know for a fact, but there's a good chance that forest was actually owned by the Weyerhaeuser family.
Yeah, incredible.
So Bill Mahan was hoping to kidnap some other guy, you know, weeks or months earlier, and he dug a hole out in the forest just for the purpose of keeping somebody stashed there. But then he realized the person he wanted to kidnap didn't have the money, and so he forgot about it. Well, now all of a sudden he's got George Weyerhaeuser. That's where he's going to keep the kids stashed. So this hole in the ground, which is basically the size of a grave, it's about 6 feet long and 4 feet deep, 3 feet wide, with some boards across the bottom, and they put George in the hole, and they chained him up. And they threw some boards over the top and camouflaged it. And so George is sitting there for a couple of days, you know, in pitch dark, 9 years old. And after the first day, they realized, okay, because like hikers happened to be nearby, they discovered we got to move him. So they moved him to another hole in the ground in another forest. Then after about another day, they went, okay, things are getting too hot, because now it's on the front page everywhere, and it's on the radio everywhere. You know, it's literally on the front page of every newspaper in America, and the cops are fanning out all over the state looking for the kidnappers and looking for George. And so they decided they want to take George back to Spokane. Now, during all this, Margaret is still oblivious. She has no idea that George has been kidnapped. She has no idea that her husband has part of what's going on with this as well.
Right.
So this is a funny thing. Bill Mahan goes back and gets Margaret, drives her back out into the forest. And she's like, why are we out here? And he goes, well, I got to get your husband. And she's like, what's my husband doing out in the forest? So he says, shut up, just sit here. He goes off into the forest. A few minutes later, her husband comes back with a flashlight. He gets in the car and says, Margaret, I need you to get on your hands and knees on the front seat and cover your head, and then I'm going to fold the seat over you. She's like, what? He says, just shut up and do it. Okay, she gets on her hands and knees. He puts the seat over her head. Then all of a sudden she hears the trunk open and slam. She has no idea that George Weyerhaeuser had just been put in the trunk of the car. So they start driving back across the state. Halfway across the state, they stop to get gas, and Margaret hears a voice out of the trunk saying, hey, mister, can you let me out now? She freaks out, going, oh, my God, all the puzzle pieces fall into place, and she realizes they've got the kid who's on the front page of every paper in America. And then Bill Mahan pulls out a gun and says, you're going to keep your mouth shut or I kill you. I kill George. I kill your husband. So she keeps her mouth shut. They drive back to Spokane, where they've got that house. They rent a house again, okay? The same house that they were in before. But this is an interesting thing that nobody seems to understand why they did this. Driving back across the state, they went past Spokane. Spokane is really close to the Washington-Idaho border. It's literally just a few miles away. They drove across the border into Idaho for like a few hours and then drove back into Spokane again. No reason why, but because they did that, it officially became a federal offense. They didn't know that at the time, or if they did, they weren't saying why. So they rent this house from a pastor, a local pastor in Spokane, and the pastor would come over to the house saying, okay, I want you to take good care of my house and water my lawn. And they're like, yes, ma'am, of course, ma'am. Little does she know that 25 feet away, George Weyerhaeuser is locked in the closet. And that's where they kept George stashed away for the next 5 days.
Now, meanwhile, you say that the family's getting this money together. They go to the uncles. They don't have any liquid assets. But also the press is clamoring for a story, and Hoover and the G-men have been told not to say anything. So they start speculating. They say making up stuff and printing anything that they can possibly print. They're desperate. And there are somebody in the FBI, I guess, is speaking about the Karpus gang. Tell us about how the Karpus gang gets to be number one suspects in this.
Alvin Karpus, Alvin Creepy Karpus, was pretty much the last of the big-time criminals that hadn't been killed or put in prison. Just a year before George had been kidnapped, Bonnie and Clyde had been gunned down, and John Dillinger had been gunned down, and Machine Gun Kelly, I can't remember if he was shot or if he was put in prison, and Babyface Nelson, all these really famous criminals had either been shot or they'd been put in prison. So Karpus, he and, you've heard of Ma Barker?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Barker-Karpus gang were kind of the last of the big-time criminals, and Karpus was really famous for doing a couple of really big kidnappings just, you know, about a year earlier. So he was number one suspect. And back in those days, the newspapers never used the term allegedly. They just speculated, and that was that. So they were putting articles out there that pretty much just plain and simple said, it's clearly the Karpus gang. They're the ones that did it. They're guilty. They were the judge and jury, and it happened frequently. So that's why everybody just thought, oh, it must be the Karpus gang.
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, there is contact by the family with this Post-Intelligencer newspaper. So they're doing things abiding by these rules. And so they contact them and tell them, listen, we're going to be doing this. We're going to try to cooperate as much as we can. What happens in that regard, meeting those kidnappers' demands?
Right. So the family tells the FBI, back off. Do not do anything until we make the money drop. And Hoover and the FBI agree. They said, okay, we'll sit back and mind our P's and Q's until the money has been exchanged, and then we jump into FBI mode. And the family said, okay. So George's dad is instructed to go stay at this hotel in downtown Seattle. And then the kidnapper, I think it might have been, I can't remember if it was Bill Mann. He comes up to this guy standing on a street corner, a cabbie, and says, hey, here's an envelope. I want you to take it to this hotel and for this name. Gives him $2. The guy says, sure, no problem. Inside there is the next instructions. Okay, so he goes to the hotel, hands it off, gives it to George's dad. And the instructions say, okay, you're ready to make the money drop because we saw in the paper that you had said we're ready to go, signed Percy Minnie. So George's dad, they've got the $200,000 in small unmarked bills. Now, I'll give you a little backstory on that. That took a lot of doing to get the money. Then on top of it, the FBI had to keep a record of every single serial number. That's 20,000 serial numbers for all this money. And that took them over 4,000 man hours to do. And they only had 5 days to pull that off.
Wow.
A lot of people were working on this. In fact, a full 7% of the entire FBI were in Seattle and Tacoma for this case. So they collect all of these ransom bill serial numbers and got them, you know, 55 pages, you know, seven columns with 50 numbers per column, and just a booklet of these numbers. Okay, so now George's dad has got this suitcase full of money, and the letter from the kidnapper said, "You will drive to this location, and you will go to this abandoned house, and in the yard you'll find a little stick of wood with a piece of white fabric attached to it, like a flag. And under that you'll find a tin can. And inside the tin can, you'll find a note that'll instruct you to the next place." So this is playing out like a Hollywood movie at this point, okay, like a bogey film. Mm-hmm. So his dad drives out there by himself, and he goes to this abandoned house, and he sees in the yard this little stick of wood, and he finds the note inside of a tin can, and it says, "Go to this next location." So he drives to the next location, to another place, another little piece of wood with another flag, except there's no tin can and there's no note. He's freaking out because the ransom money is due that night or else. He's crawling around on his hands and knees in the dark with matches looking for it. After a couple hours, he gives up. He heads back to the hotel. The next morning, the kidnappers call, pissed off, saying, "Hey, where's our money?" And he's like, "I tried, but the second note wasn't there." And they went, "All right, we're going to give you one more chance." So they gave him new instructions. So that night, he goes to a new location. Again, the same drill, rinse and repeat. They find a flag. They find the tin can. They find a note. They take it to another one, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, the last note says, "Park your car, leave the dome light on, leave the money in the back seat, start walking back down the road." His dad does this. After he's about 100 yards away, he hears a noise behind him, looks back, sees somebody jump out of the bushes, jump into the car, and drive away. Bill Mahan now has $200,000. So he drives to this abandoned, well, not abandoned, you know, a shack that he had Margaret waiting for him with. And he brings back the money, and now they've got their money. So then they head back to Spokane, and they've got $200,000. And now it's time to hand over George.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 90%, 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting the recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. But Ritual didn't stop there. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. The results: Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. I've been taking Ritual for about a year now, and I started when my wife had been taking Ritual Essential for Women for about 2 years, and she felt it had made a significant difference in her daily routine. So when it became available for men and teens, I took Ritual 50 Plus, and I've been taking it for about a year, and I feel it's made a significant difference in my daily routine. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, we talked about that Bill Mahan and Harmon, but Bill Mahan had in his possession $200,000, and they had stipulated they want him in 20s, certain denominations in 20s, certain number of 20s, yeah. 10s, and 5s. Despite their demands, how difficult was it going to be to spend any of that money, and what was the plan for Mahan and Harmon in regards to that money being spent?
Well, that was, again, part of their undoing. They weren't as smart as they thought they were. because they said they want small unmarked bills. All right, well, fine. It's easy to have an unmarked bill. You don't have to put a mark on it. But as long as you've got the serial number, then that, you know, if the money shows up, it can be traced. Mm-hmm. And I guess they didn't really think that far in advance. Again, they weren't the sharpest tools in the shed. And as I'll get to a little bit down the road here when we're talking about this, that was their undoing. Yeah, they tried to not spend it, but they couldn't. They didn't have money tucked away for spending money for like a 6-month period, which is what they should have done. Okay, so they eventually had to spend some, and that's how the FBI eventually caught up with them. But like I said, we'll chat about that here in a few minutes.
Let's talk about Margaret herself. Now, in the beginning, she's beyond naive to not see certain things. But at some point, she, like you say, she puts it together when she hears the boy's voice talking about, is it time to get out of this trunk here, mister? So she puts it all together. Then she's threatened. So she now, no matter how naive she was before, knows exactly what's gone on and what she's been a participant in. So how does she act now that they have some money? And tell us about this split and where the two perpetrators went after the money.
So after they drop off George, which is a great story I'll get to here in just a minute, but after they drop off George and they kind of go their separate ways, Margaret and Harmon go their separate way, and Bill Mahan goes his separate way. And actually, once they go their separate ways, they never see each other again, period. That was the last they ever saw of each other. So Margaret and Harmon got about $95,000, and Mahan took like $105,000 or something to that effect. So he says, okay, you Harmon and Margaret, you guys go to Salt Lake City if you want. That's fine, because that's where she's from. And he says, I'm just going to go my own way. So they whipped up this plan where they gave her two suitcases. You know, again, Margaret being Margaret, she's very naive, very trusting, and also not very smart. So Harmon says, here, take this suitcase, and you're gonna take the train to Salt Lake City, and I'm going to join you when I get down there, and I'll bring the money with me. She doesn't realize that she's got that $95,000 in a suitcase with her.
Wow.
She doesn't realize it. She's sitting there on the train with her feet propped up on top of the suitcase. What she also doesn't realize is that Harmon is on the train, and he's spying on her. She thinks that he's not coming till the next day, but he actually went on the same train to keep an eye on her. So she gets down to Salt Lake City. Harmon shows up there the next day, and they rent a house, and they start going about their business. So she knows what's happened. She knows what they did was wrong, but she was also terrified of Bill Mahan and his gun. And so she just went along stupidly or naively or just because she was terrified. You know, I'm not sure which it was, probably a little bit of all three. And that was the fall of Margaret.
Let's get back to George, because even though the family followed the instructions of the kidnappers, they did a little change in the procedure at the end. So tell us about George. And what was amazing about this story is, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, about the trauma, but right away in the beginning, we're struck by how calm George is. He's not screaming or yelling, and it's attributed to, you write in the book, what the kidnappers had said to him and then the treatment by those kidnappers. So how was it that George, at 9 years old, had the wherewithal and the ability to be able to handle this? What was his source of optimism in his mind?
Well, I think it was a couple of things. First off, he's 9 years old, and he will frequently, 9 years old, will believe what adults will tell them. You know, they're very trusting. And they said, keep your mouth shut and we won't hurt you. All right, so he's going to keep his mouth shut so they won't hurt him. And then another thing happened. Bill Mahan, when George was blindfolded and taken off into the forest, at one point they went across the stream. George hears the water, and he's thinking, are they going to toss me in the river? Are they going to toss me in the stream, whatever, and drown me because they're done with me? And he asked, you know, Mahan that, hey, mister, are you going to throw me in the river and drown me? And Mahan said, kid, you're worth too much alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when George realized, okay, as long as I keep quiet, I'm worth something to them. And so he just kept quiet. And Harmon Whaley, you know, Harmon was kind of watched, took care of George for the 5 days back in Spokane while Mahan martyred while making trips back and forth. And according to George, Harmon was okay with him. He didn't treat him poorly. He was a reasonable man, is what he said. And so, yeah, George, that was the reason George hung in there, because he trusted that nothing was going to happen to him. So now let's talk about how George has dropped off, because this is a great part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So they're driving back from Spokane, and driving back, Mahan and Whaley are discussing where we're going to drop off George, because they hadn't really thought that far in advance. Again, A, not the smartest, sharpest tools in the shed.
Yeah.
So they finally realize, let's drop him back off in the forest near that hole in the ground where we kept him a week earlier. So they take him up this old timber road, and they drop him off by this, it's I wouldn't even call it a shack, it's just a glorified lean-to. And they said, okay, George, here's a blanket, here's a dollar. We're going to leave you here. Your dad's going to come pick you up. And they drove away. It's midnight. Okay. And they just dropped this 9-year-old off on a timber road in pitch dark out in the forest, and it's raining. So George is sitting there in the rain in the dark for a couple hours, and his dad's not coming. He doesn't know that, though, because his dad doesn't even know where he's been dropped off. He doesn't even know that he has been dropped off. So after a while, George says, this is stupid. I've had enough of this. And so he starts walking, and he walks for miles, and he finally comes across this old farmer's house. It's about 6 o'clock in the morning. He's drenched. He knocks on the door, and the farmer opens the door, and there's this soaking wet kid standing on the front porch, and he says, hi, I'm George Weyerhaeuser. Can you take me to my folks? So this farmer answers the door, and the kid, who's been on the front page of every newspaper in America, just magically appeared on his front porch.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's George Weyerhaeuser. They throw him in their Model T and they take off, taking him back to Tacoma. About halfway between Issaquah and Tacoma is a community called Renton. And they get about as far as Renton, and the farmer pulls over, goes to a gas station and makes a phone call to the Weyerhaeusers, because evidently you can just grab a phone book and call these really rich people because their number's listed. So they call the Weyerhaeuser house, and the FBI had this elaborate phone system set up just for this phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone system failed utterly, completely failed. The FBI agent that's at the house hears the phone ring. He's supposed to wait for it to ring 5 times or something to that effect. I forget exactly what it was. But it rang once, and then it was silent. And the FBI agent picked it up, and he listens, and it's dead silent. There's nothing. The farmer, on his end, it's just ringing and ringing and ringing. And he let it ring for 4 minutes long, but nobody's picking it up. And finally, he gets fed up, and he hangs up the phone. So then he calls the police. Now, this is really interesting, and it depends on who you believe. You either believe the reporter or you believe the FBI. So now the reporters have been camped out at the Weyerhaeuser house for days, waiting for their big break. Media circus, all right? In fact, the Weyerhaeuser house had become like this tourist attraction. Cars lined up down the road, people stealing flowers out of their yard as souvenirs. So the reporters, they get wind that George has been released, but they don't know any particulars. Now, the reporter, this guy by the name of John Dreher, he was a golf reporter for the Seattle Times, and he claims that he got a tip from his publisher that George had been released and like in Issaquah, and was driving back in a Model T through rent from Renton. Okay, that's what he claims. Now, here's what the FBI says. The FBI claims that the reporter was in the Tacoma police station and overheard the phone call between the farmer and the police officer. And he went, okay, the kid is coming this way in it. So the reporter gets a cab, tells the cabbie, head for Renton. We're going to try to intercept George before the FBI. And so they drive down the highway. Now, granted, this is 1935. There's not a lot of cars on the road. And sure enough, they see a Model T coming the other direction. And they see George in the front seat. So, you know, the reporter's like, there he is, there he is, go get him. Cabbie spins around, drives up, pulls alongside him, waving at him like they're trying to pull the car over. The Model T pulls over. The reporter jumps out of the model, jumps out of the cabbie, runs over, insinuates to the farmer that he's with the police when he's not, gives the farmer $5. Farmer hands George over, no questions asked, to the stranger. Could have been another kidnapper. Hands George over. The reporter puts George in the back seat of the cab below the window level, gets in the back seat on the floorboards below the window level, tells the cabbie, drive back to George's house, take your time, go on back roads, and then he interviews George for like the biggest scoop. Pulitzer Prize, you know, wasn't a winner, but it was a nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for this humongous scoop that's on the front page the next morning. Incredible. So then they get to George's house. George is reunited with his family. Everybody goes crazy. Everybody's all excited. And then becomes the greatest manhunt in Northwest history.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. You talk about this biggest manhunt in Northwest history. Part of that is obviously tracking these bills. So as we talked about, it was their undoing. It's interesting that Margaret spends some of that money and very little of it. But again, in this primitive laundering technique, you take a $20 bill and you buy something for a few cents, 25 cents. Tell us about this undoing. And meanwhile, while the authorities are on their trail.
Correct. So the FBI are just waiting. They're just waiting for that first bill to show up because they know it's going to happen eventually. And sure enough, it does. Harmon had used one of the bills to get a train ticket. And for whatever reason, the guy who sold him the ticket, he didn't recognize him as a kidnapper. He just remembered him, like the hat he was wearing or the coat he was wearing. For whatever reason, the guy happened to remember that. And he remembered that that he'd bought a train ticket to Salt Lake City. And then Margaret, she's got some of the bills, and she goes to like a store called Cress, and she buys some stuff. Then she goes to a Woolworths, and she decides she's going to buy a cigarette case for her dad for his birthday. A 20-cent cigarette case, and she gives him $5. Now, back in those days, a lot of stores don't do the exchange right there at the counter. They take the money and they go back to what's called a cash cage, where they've got a person back there. So they take the $5 bill, they go back to the cash cage, they give the $5 over to that woman. And she's got one of those booklets that has all the serial numbers. And she just, you know, force of habit, flip, 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 flip. Bingo. It's one of the bills. Oh my gosh, this is a ransom bill. She calls the police. In short order, the police arrive and they grab Margaret. And it doesn't take long for her to crack. And it doesn't take long before they nab Harmon as well. And there you go. They've got two of the kidnappers right there on the spot. And they take them off to be sent before the judge. Word gets out that Harmon and Margaret have been busted. And Bill Mahan, he, for whatever reason, I think he went down to Salt Lake City also. I'm not sure exactly why. And he heard that his compatriots have been busted. So he hightails it to Butte, Montana. The next morning, he's standing on a street corner, 7 o'clock in the morning, and he looks across the street, and there's a police officer, and the cop is staring at him, and he's staring at the cop, and the cop keeps staring at him. Well, Bill Mahan starts getting nervous, thinking, okay, he's on to me, and he takes off running. Well, the police officer didn't recognize him as a kidnapper because he had no idea that Bill Mahan was one of the kidnappers. The cop recognized him because he'd arrested Bill Mahan 3 years earlier. So, pure chance, he sees the guy that he'd arrested, and now the guy that he'd arrested makes a break for it. So he goes chasing after him. Bill Mahan jumps over the fence of this yard, and there's a guard dog in the yard, all right? And the cop jumps over the fence as well. Mahan has run past the guard dog, so the guard dog turns on the cop. The cop's got to make a choice, okay? Shoot the dog and capture the guy who's running away from him, or not shoot the dog. He chooses to not shoot the dog. And as a result, Bill Mahan escapes for another year. So now we get to Margaret and Harmon, taken back to Tacoma, and they're going before the judge. Harmon, guilty. I'm guilty, I'm guilty, I'm guilty. Fine. 45 years, you're going to Alcatraz. That's it. Margaret, guilty, guilty, guilty. But Harmon says, wait a minute, she's not guilty. She didn't know anything about it. She didn't participate other than going along with it once she found out about it. But she never even once saw George, which is true. She never once saw him. They make sure to always keep her out of sight of George. So the judge says, wait a minute, you want to plead guilty, but you didn't really participate in the kidnapping. And she's like, yes. He's like, well, why would you do that? She's like, I can't imagine my life while my husband is in prison, me being free. And the judge thinks, you know, this is stupid. No.
Yeah.
You are going to plead not guilty, and it's going to go to trial. And that's what he forced her to do. And then it became this enormous trial in Seattle. Enormous trial. Biggest trial in Seattle history at this point. Huge. Huge, huge, huge. And would you like me to chat about that right now?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Sure. So Margaret has, as her defendant, as her public defender, is this really talented lawyer who was the former mayor of Seattle. And he was smart enough to realize that she's got no prayer. She's got no chance. And so he portrays her. This is his defense. He portrays her as the stupidest person on the planet, as a total moron, a complete idiot who would jump off the building if her husband told her to. And he's on her side, okay?
Yeah.
And poor Margaret, you know, the media are saying things like they're describing her as plain and plump. The woman weighed 120 pounds, you know? But they just basically saw her as a figure of pity. And, you know, they go through, while this trial is going on, meanwhile, in the Seattle and Tacoma, all the Puget Sound area, there's a massive timber strike going on. And there are riots in the streets, and there's tear gas, and there's National Guardsmen with bayonets, and people are getting shot, and cars are being dynamited. All this is playing on in the backdrop of this massive trial. So like I said, this thing's playing out like a movie, okay? And so finally, the jury, which this was interesting too, they list, you know, they describe every person on the jury. They describe if it's a man, if it's a woman, what their name is, what they do for a living, and where they live, all right? And they even described it as a better looking than most jury in the newspaper.
Jeez.
So the jury goes off, and in short order, they come back and they say Margaret's guilty. Okay, she's guilty, but not to the same degree that Harmon and Bill Mahan are. So
right.
She gets 20 years in a work farm, and she says, I count the days till I'll be back, you know, with my husband Harmon, blah, 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 blah. That lasted about 12 hours. While she's being taken back east to Michigan, on the way back, she's like, that jerk, everything bad that's happened to me is because of him. I am swearing off men for the rest of my life. The day she gets out of prison, she divorced Harmon. So Harmon gets 45 years in prison. Bill Mahan gets 60 years in Alcatraz. And they're also there at the same time that Al Capone is there. And evidently, Harmon, who was a small-time petty criminal, and according to George, is a very reasonable guy, he became kind of a hardened criminal. He got into fist fights with Al Capone and stuff like that while he was there.
And they both made it to Alcatraz, and they talk about McNeil's Island, and I've heard about this prison, and then Alcatraz, they call it the Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, as you say, Harmon turned into a leader at involved in one of the riots at Alcatraz.
Correct.
As well.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, they were both at McNeil Island, which is up in Puget Sound, you know, Washington State, for like a year, if even that, before they were sent down to Alcatraz. In fact, I think Bill Mahan, he went to like Leavenworth, and he went to a few prisons before he went to Alcatraz, but he spent the vast majority of his time at Alcatraz. And I think Mahan served 25 years of his 40 before he was released. Margaret did, I think, 14 years of her 20 before she was released. And I can't remember how many Mahan served, but it was a pretty good chunk.
You had the great opportunity to speak to George Weyerhaeuser in 2019. How old was he, and how did you manage to be able to get an interview with him, and tell us about that?
Yeah, that was interesting. It was really hard tracking him down, as a matter of fact. It took me quite a while. But I finally found a phone number, and I called it, and it was a voicemail that they would check like once a week. And I left a message saying, "Hi, George, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm a local author, and I would love to be able to chat with you about your kidnapping, unless it's a really uncomfortable subject." Because whenever I'd read any articles about the Weyerhaeuser kidnapping, there would always be some family member saying, "George doesn't like to talk about the kidnapping." So I really didn't expect to get anything. So about 3 days later, I got a voicemail from George saying, "Brian, this is George Weyerhaeuser. Happy to chat with you. Happened a long time ago. Not an uncomfortable subject at all." I'm like, holy crap. So I call back up, and he agrees to sit down with me. So I drive down to his house, and he lives in a very nice house. It's not like a humongous mansion or anything. And he's sitting out on the back porch by the lake, and I start chatting with him, and I'm like, "George, how old are you anyway?" He says, "Brian, I'll be 94 next week." And I'm like, "Oh, man, I should look so good when I'm 94. So we go inside the house, and he and his daughter sit there, and we chat for a couple hours, and he's just delightful. He still remembered a fair amount of things. He was pretty sharp. Some things, that were hard for him to remember. Granted, it was 85 years since the kidnapping.
Right.
But I was asking him things like, I was asking him, like, "George, I mean, did you have any really bad, PTSD after this? Did you have stress or nightmares?" He's like, "Nope, none at all." "Really? Nope, none at all." "Okay. After you were returned, did your parents just bring the clamps down on you and drive you everywhere and just hover over you?" "Nope. Not at all. They wanted me to get back to normal life as quickly as possible. They let me walk to school again." I'm like, "You got to be kidding me."
Yeah,
so that's the kind of stuff we just chatted about. I asked him, I said, "Now, when you were in college, this has got to be the best pickup line in history. You got to have talked to girls saying, 'Yeah, I'm George Weyerhaeuser. You probably heard of me. I got kidnapped once.'" And he said, nope, never did it once." I'm like, this is nuts. I can't believe this. But which then takes us, I'm wondering if I should give away this ending. It's such a remarkable ending. It's such an uplifting ending. But I'm wondering aloud now if I should give it away or not. But it's such a great story. But I guess my thinking on it is, when I went to go see the movie Titanic, I knew that the boat was going to sink, but I still enjoyed the movie anyway.
Absolutely,
so
absolutely.
I'll leave it up to you. Should I give away this great ending or not?
Well, Brian, the thing is, to back it up, to give it a little bit more context to this end, incredible ending, is that when Harmon was sentenced, you write that he wrote letters to George. So tell us about what he wrote to George, what sentiment he expressed in those letters to George, and then what happened when Harmon was released from prison.
So yeah, during the years with Harmon, he would write letters, very apologetic letters to George for years. He would just, I'm so sorry about what happened, and I really never meant you any harm, et cetera, et cetera. So he did this numerous times while he was in prison. So then 25 years after the kidnapping, George by this time is, 33 years old, 34 years old, and he's just a couple years short of becoming the president and CEO of this massive corporation. And he gets a phone call, and he answers the phone, and it's Harmon Whaley. He says, "Hi, George, this is Harmon Whaley. I just got out of prison. I could sure use a job." And George hired him. George hired his kidnapper.
Extraordinary.
It's unbelievable. And I said, "George, wait, you hired your kidnapper?" He says, "Yeah." I think my dad would have thought I was nuts. And I went, why would you do that? And he said, "Well, when I was kidnapped and he was looking after me, he was a reasonable man. And it had been a long time. And he struck me still as a reasonable man. And I simply thought he would appreciate it." And that was it. That was his reasoning.
Extraordinary. He also said to you, you asked him his age, and he said, almost 94.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, "Listen."
Yes.
He said, "I'm 94. You better write fast." Because he was talking about your book.
Yeah.
He said, "You better write fast."
That's exactly what he said. He said, "Brian, how long is it going to take you to write this book?" And I said, "Well, I had to write it and find an agent and find a publisher and go through the whole rigmarole." I said, "Probably 2 years." And he said, "Brian, I'm almost 94. Write fast."
Yeah. And I imagine George is still with us today?
He is. He's 96 years old. He's doing okay. He's got dementia. But he's still hanging around. He's had a very good life. And the family is obviously very protective of him and still keep a very low profile whenever they can.
Yes. And it's incredible in your book, too, when you get George goes to trial and testifies at that trial. It's, again, extraordinary exchanges at this trial.
Yeah, I always had the pleasure to go through the court transcripts. And so, in the book, there are times where there are conversations that I didn't know exactly what was being said, but I simply extrapolated based on my research and what I knew of the characters and what they would talk about, what they would say. But in the courtroom, everything in the book, any words, any conversations in the courtroom are taken verbatim. Everything you see on the printed page is exactly what was said in the courtroom.
Yes. Well, it's an extraordinary story and a remarkable book that you've written, Deep in the Woods, the 1935 kidnapping of 9-year-old George Weyerhaeuser, heir to America's mightiest timber dynasty. For those people that might want to check out more about this book, do you have a Facebook page or website? Tell us more about this.
Well, yeah, you can. I've got a website, Brian R. Johnston, but you can honestly, go to Barnes & Noble, go to Amazon, go to any bookstore, and you'll be able to find it. You can order it, pretty much anywhere at this point in time. But that's your best place to find information on it. You can just type in "Deep in the Woods," George Weyerhaeuser, and something will come up about it.
And what's the release date for this, Brian?
It just came out earlier this week, as a matter of fact.
July 21st.
Actually, last week, last Tuesday. That was just last Tuesday, so it was the 14th. Yeah.
Yes, there we go.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much, Brian Johnston, for coming on and talking about Deep in the Woods, 1935 kidnapping of 9-year-old George Weyerhaeuser, heir to America's mightiest timber dynasty. It's been an absolute pleasure, Brian. Thank you so much. You have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it very much. Good night.